This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Brian Koberger, behind bars, obviously not having a great time. Siobhan Scott here to help us break down what goes on with a mind behind bars, especially solitary confinement, isolation, all that inside prison. We've talked about it with folks like Richard Allen and the Delphi case, but Koberger is a bit of a different study. Within weeks, he's already filed complaints about vegan meals, alleged harassment, even begged to be moved out of J Block because he can't handle the taunting. He's written letters full of paranoia, obsessing over control, over food, over whether he's being listened to. I wanted to dig into what this all tells us psychologically. When you strip away the legal details, what do these behaviors reveal about his mind in isolation? Siobhan?
You're really seeing what jumped out at me is the manifestation of his OCD, mm-hmm. which goes back many years, and the online forums he was participating in and talking about his purity of his food and all of that. There's so much wrong with this guy. You know, we talk about him being narcissistic and psychopathic, which is all true. But he's also got this, if we want to call it autism or schizoid personality disorder, we wouldn't really be able to hone that in precisely without doing psych testing on him. But he's got a lot of other things wrong. So he's not just your average psychopathic narcissist. He's got this other quality, which is a glitch in his brain. And whenever a person is incarcerated, I think whatever their predisposing problems are, it intensifies because of the stress. Mm-hmm. And so this is a guy who's very, very uncomfortable. And he's going back to his coping mechanisms of trying to gain control and trying to have everything just the way he wants it. And it's obviously it's not going to work.
It's not going to happen in prison. No matter how many letters he writes about not getting his extra side of mashed peas or whatever they're serving that day because they were out of something else. It doesn't matter. He's not, everything's not going to line up all neatly for him the way he wants it to be. What is that going to do to a brain like that? Because again, it's never going to change. This is life going forward. Mm-hmm. And there ain't nothing he can do or say to stop that. It's already a very broken brain, mm-hmm. but what does this do to the already broken brain on the only way it seems to know to ride down its rails?
Mm-hmm. It doesn't look good for him. Is he going to deteriorate into more overt mental illness? Quite possibly. Is he going to, I mean, I'm guessing at this point, they've probably put him on some psych meds to try to calm him down. If not, I would guess that that's in his future. Could he become increasingly paranoid to the point that we're saying this is really psychotic? Mm-hmm. I think that's what the isolation did to Richard Allen. I think he may have had a pre-existing fragility, mm-hmm. and he became very psychotic in jail because of it in prison. So it certainly could go that way.
I'm wondering about, because we've seen three of the letters, one of them about the food tray. And I mean, it was in detail, and it was, what would you like us to do to fix this problem? How do you think we should have? And he goes into great detail. Is that like a survival technique in his brain where you're going to obsess on something and that brain needs something to obsess on? And I'm going to guess, you know, the lunch menu items might be an easier one to stomach than, you know, who's going to be coming and eating you for lunch, as it was suggested through one of the taunts that he pointed out. It reminds me somewhat of individuals that will watch a lot of true crime, who have very strong fears of being a victim of true crime, maybe have been a victim of crime, or who will get into crime, into horror, and watch it on the screen because it's safe. It can't get at you. It's over there. But it fills that curiosity. It fills that void that seems to be there. Is this that same sort of thing where the reality, the darkness, the scariness, it's all there, but if he spends time on that, that's going to drive him nuts. So we better worry far more about the tuna casserole.
Yeah, it's a desperate attempt to have control of something that he still thinks he can have control of. Mm-hmm. Because it's a very scary thing to be in a situation where you've lost all control. Mm-hmm. And he's definitely lost control here. And as you mentioned, he's under threat, overt threat. And I mean, we can all say, well, if anybody deserves it, this guy deserves to suffer in that way. But he's got to be struggling with what in the world does he come up with that he can control. And you're right, it's the menu.
Do you think Koberger, I mean, Koberger seems like someone who's always struggled with getting any sort of control. It feels like most of his life, I mean, at least from my perspective, it feels like he didn't have control. He was out of control. Everything he tried, there were some things he lost that weight, so he got a little confidence mm-hmm. there. Yeah. But it seems most of the things he set out to do, he failed at. And mm-hmm. and it all went downhill. He starts with confidence, and then slowly the real world catches up and points mm-hmm. out, this is not correct. Is that just an always having a quest for control because he's lacked having it for so long in his life and in so many situations?
Yeah, that, and it also strikes me that as much as I think he was studying the criminal mind and various aspects of abnormal psychology, he has been desperate to understand himself. Mm-hmm. And I think he probably saw facets of himself in the forensic studies and the other serial killers he was studying. But I still think at this point, he doesn't have very good insight into what is really going on in his own mind. And so he keeps looking for things, looking for solutions, looking for an explanation. And mm-hmm. he's just so messed up. He never finds it. He doesn't really get it.
Is there anything to find? I guess would be the question. I mean, in a way, if you take the murders out of the equation and you go back to Brian Koberger circa, 20-teen something, when he was writing those things about the visual snow online and feeling no empathy, feeling nothing towards his dad and how he was treating him, and just being really emotionless to anyone but himself. Mm-hmm. Is there a self to find? I mean, is there something deeper down that he is missing? And I mean, if there's, let me just ask that, is there something deeper to find? Is there anything that he's going to dig into there?
If I were working with him, God forbid, if I were, I would just work to help him understand that his brain is different from other people. And as much as he may want to identify as a psychopath, he also needs to understand autistic people and understand obsessive compulsive disorder, and then come to a place of seeing how this has colored his worldview and his relationships with other people. And that may be the best you could do with him, because yeah, he doesn't have that same ego core that the rest of us have that allows us to have deep attachments with people. And that's probably not something that he can manufacture. But could he come to a better understanding of the way his obsessive tendencies and his obsessive personality, the way that this impacts him? Mm-hmm. And obviously, we've heard a lot more coming out about his social problems.
Yeah.
And could he gain some awareness of how he comes off to other people? And I don't think he's had a clue about that.
Yeah, I don't think he has either. Even when it's spelled, if someone were to go and spell out in front of him, if we were to walk over to him with a video and go, look at this, look at the way you're interacting here and how this doesn't match up, would he be defensive? Would he go, well, I'm doing this because of this, and have an answer to those questions as to why he's acting the way he is? Or is there any, does he have an ability to be introspective on himself?
He has limited ability, and that's sure the thing that you would probably try to plug away with is trying to confront him and point these things out. Some of the I heard some forensic discussions this week from people who were going over his phone and his laptop and trying to trace the frequency of his calls to his parents. Yeah. And apparently he still calls them, he always called them mother and father.
Yes.
I mean, how weird is that? Who does that? And his way of being in the world, and yet he was calling them daily. And so this makes me think, was he completely dependent on them to try to be grounded in reality, to talk about his goals and plans? You know, whenever I've seen a college student who has to call a parent daily, it's because they're really fragile and they need a lot of structure and a lot of help. And it's not a good sign. But the whole mother father thing, it's like they're just everything about this guy, the more we learn, red flags that he was off. He was weird. It was really what I had guessed when they talked about they couldn't track all of his pornography use, but they could track a lot of searches. I think it was through the phone that he hadn't been able to completely cover it up. And what did we have? We had rape, we had unconscious victim, and we had voyeurism. And that does not surprise me at all. And I remember you and I were talking about when they were saying, oh, well, his main activity at night, he likes to go out driving. And I said, he's peeping. That's, you know, sex offenders who are out at night, they're looking in windows. And so it's like every part of this guy's life was off.
Yeah, I have always said where he initially made that statement, gazing at the stars, looking at the stars, stargazing. That's code for something else. Like he's saying it's stargazing, and to rest of us, we think looking at the stars. He means looking through college girls' windows. Is really what it is. Why is that? Like, look, if you're really that hard up for physical attention from the sex that you're attracted to, why is it that people will go and be interested in such dark, bizarre ways of looking at like the physicality of the human body, and we're looking at it in such weird ways of voyeurism, of passed out, of negrophilia. I mean, just all these dark, like nothing, anything anyone should ever want to be involved in. But somehow this is clicking in his mind as that's hot. I mean, is that a trauma response, or is that just somehow his brain is into doing the dead?
It's paraphilia, you know, are categories of weird sexual, the things that excite people versus what most of us, you know, most of us can form bonds and have an emotional connection. Well, he doesn't do that. And so I think these particular ones with an unconscious woman or peeping someone that doesn't know he's there, it gives him a sense of power and control. And obviously that was very important to him in his sexual fantasies. So I don't think it's a trauma response. Again, I think it's you've got a broken brain with this guy, and he became probably very fixated on control. And he has a lot of anger, and these were sexual fantasies. Probably, you know, this porn history goes back for years, if not a couple decades.
It never clicks over to individuals like this, power, control. I mean, obviously, look, we all enjoy having control over our lives. We all enjoy having somewhat of a sense of power and agency of ourselves. There's nothing wrong with that until it goes way too far. But in a mind like this, it never clicked over like, hey, you might have healthy power and control of your own life and some a say in your relationship by developing that with someone else, not ripping all of their control away and you're the only one in control. But that seems to be the only way this equation works for his brain.
Exactly. This is, and when we talk about what's missing inside of him, it's that ability to have a deeper attachment and to have more depth in his own personality instead of this bundle of random, weird, aggressive sexual impulses that fortunately most of us do not have.
Yeah. The search that he was making the night, the 29th, as police were closing in, the 30th is when they came in and did the raid. But he seemed to feel that things were closing in. He's searching about wiretaps, and the search that really got me is paranoid psychopaths. searching how paranoid psychopaths handle the anxiety of things closing in on them, defining himself as a paranoid psychopath in that search. I would say probably most paranoid psychopaths aren't necessarily doing that sort of a search in that literal of terms there, but he's literally saying, I must, you know, that's who I am. Cause is that part of him trying to identify still with all these other killers? And this is how, well, I'm a paranoid psychopath. So how should I handle this? Mm-hmm. It's a weird way of examining the present around you.
Mm-hmm. Very weird, very weird. And it would, you know, it takes me back to why is he studying criminology and abnormal psychology, driven by an attempt to understand himself. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he could latch on to certain things at certain times because he was studying it. Mm-hmm. And so he was able to recognize that his obsessive thoughts, again, were paranoia, but there was a reason for it. So was it really paranoia, or was it simply he was having a moment of flashing on reality that they were closing in?
Yeah. I'm curious, and this would just be pure speculation, and I do have a lot of respect and a lot of empathy and a lot of grace for his parents. Mm-hmm. I'm in no way wanting to say these are bad people. They had two other daughters that are successful, and they came out of the house, and, you know, in their own little way, they're at home. I mean, they don't really have a history, as far as we know publicly, of anything bad or abuse or any of that. But the fact that mom's sitting there having these conversations with her son, it was an extreme amount of hours after he had been charged with these crimes in those prison, those jail cells, before he admitted to this. What do you think was going on in those conversations with mom?
I can only speculate that she has served throughout the course of his life to try to keep him calm, because my guess is he's always had a tendency to get wound up, to get very anxious. And often it does sort of fall to mom to be the one. I mean, when my kids very seldom have called with upset situations as adults, but occasionally, if they call, you know, if somebody's upset, one of my son's cats died suddenly, and he was just so distraught and upset. He was very bonded with his cat. Who did he call? He called mom. And so I think moms serve that function very often. Dads may too, but it's most often mom, that when somebody is cracking, that they turn to mom. And that's just sort of what mom is used to doing. And I don't ever get the sense that the parents did anything wrong with him, that they were abusive in any way, but they probably also are very used to him, we'll just say his specialness, his unique qualities, and so get very comfortable. Okay, I've got to calm him down again. That would be my guess.
I agree. I doubt they, you know, did anything wrong with him in the traditional sense of like abuse, but and it may just come down to, we don't know what to do with him. And that probably is the ultimate answer of just not knowing what, because what do you do with
what
that?
What do you do?
But is there a level in there of not doing something, or they clearly did do some things. They turned him into the police when he stole the sister's phone. But, and this is a question I'm sure they're going to be racking their brains with for the rest of their lives. Could we have done anything different? Yeah. And this is not to insult them or say, well, they should have thought of this, should have thought of that, because no one knows how to deal with someone who's capable of this. But if you were to look at it in hindsight, and you were to say, there's another parent out there that is listening to this going, you know, I'm afraid my kid's going to turn into another Brian Koberger or something of the sort. They have all the way they act, the way that they see things, and there doesn't seem to be anything to pull them back. What do you say to those parents that are sitting there wondering and waiting for, you know, the phone call to come that, you know, little, you know, Brian 2.0, you know, went and killed some people or essayed some people And you kind of knew all along this person doesn't seem to have the rails to keep them from going in those directions.
It's terribly hard. And my heart goes out to his parents and every other parent who's got a kid that just came out not quite right. And if they have antisocial tendencies, it's scary. And so, of course, I always say I have a bias for therapy. If they can get them connected mm-hmm. with a therapist, who knows how many terrible things are prevented because somebody was able to connect with a therapist. And I like mm-hmm. to think that we do some good in the world. But again, once they're 18, parents don't have any control over that. Mm-hmm. And so I would then advise parents to go talk with a therapist about strategies because mm-hmm. every family's different. Every case is going to be different. And that doesn't mean that the parents have a mental illness or a mental health condition, no. but just for problem solving. And, you know, I talk with a lot of parents over the years who came in because they were worried about a kid. A kid was doing something that was a red flag. And then we would try to problem solve on how do you cope with this and what are some interventions.
And that's what I think a lot of it comes down to is, you know, once you have your 18-year-old kid, you don't have any control. They can do whatever they want. But they kept that type on. It's not like Koberger went away and was like, I'm going to go do my random things. I mean, he obviously did, but he still kept a very tight bond with yes. them. Is there an element here to this story where maybe there was too much control? Maybe there was too much communicating unhealthily between mom and son or father and son or whatever it may be. And again, not saying that they're like, hey, go kill people or anything like yeah. that, but too much coddling, too much solving Brian's problems for him leading up to all of this where he had no problem solving skills because he obviously demonstrated early in life he didn't have very many good problem solving skills. Mm-hmm. And rather than exercise that muscle earlier, was there a level of enabling here of, you know, we're coddling this kid to such an extent that he can't handle anything out of the ordinary or anything in life that's coming towards him. And he just goes to power control, which is a very infantile way of thinking, mm-hmm. rather than a more mature way of thinking of interpersonal connection and handling things in that line, but he goes to power and control. Is this a reflection sometimes? I'm not saying it of them, but I'm saying it in general of over coddling of these kids to the point they're 30 something and still need to get mom and dad's approval yeah. or they need to borrow this or they need to borrow that. It's like, can we just get our kids to grow the F up at some point in time and let them be adults and mm-hmm. rather still mm-hmm. stop coddling? And because sometimes in a healthy mind, it can work out okay. But when you don't have a healthy mind, I think you get more of this sort of folk.
Mm-hmm. It sure can develop into that. I'm thinking of another friend who tries to control every class her kid is taking in college. Mm-hmm. And she's already got picked out. I mean, she picked out his college. She picked out his major. And she's also got his career path planned. And so she monitors his homework assignments. And we're talking about a 20-year-old. And, you know, that's my message to her all the time is let him. So what if he screws up? Maybe he'll fail a class. That's a learning experience, right? You can't control everything. And she does it in a way of being loving and supportive and wanting him to have success. But it's really about her needs.
Yeah.
To have her child be a perfect reflection of her. So then we go back yeah. to the Adelsons and the narcissism thing yeah. there of the over-involved parent. But yes, yeah, I think that's the goal in parenting yeah. is we don't want to raise a dependent adult. We want to raise an independent person. Yeah. And that should be throughout childhood, encouraging more independence and autonomy. And of course, you have to do that in an age-appropriate way because when they're little, they need a lot more help and support. Mm-hmm. But that's the goal, is to let them be independent.
Yeah. I mean, and when you get that, like we were giving that example there, is she doing that because she wants that child to succeed and lead a happy and healthy life? Or is she doing that because she wants to go and tell her friends, oh, look, they're doing this. This is the vision I had for them. And, oh, I'm so proud of them. But at the end of the day, they're proud of themselves because they jammed their kid into this slot.
Very true.
And they're fitting the mold, at least until they crack. Yeah. And they're like, I don't want to do any of this.
Yeah,
I mean, very true. Yeah, I mean, that seems to be a lot of it goes back to the ego, not necessarily of the kid, but of the parent in some situations like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and a lot of things that are framed as love mm-hmm. are really about concern for self and concern for mm-hmm. own ego rather than what is really best for my son here. Yeah.
It seems to come back to a fear of letting the kids fail. And mm-hmm. and I think most successful people will say failing are the best things in life because it teaches you how to do better. It teaches you what doesn't work, what does work, and it strengthens you. But I feel like we get so many folks out there today that have no experience in failure and the smallest of hiccups mm-hmm. in the world, like not getting the fruits on the tray at lunch and he wants the extras. Mm-hmm. It turns into a major, major issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. And we don't do our kids a service when we create dependency and no. when they're dependent on us for basic mood regulation. But everybody's different. And yep. yeah, I think Brian came out of the chute with some abnormal ways of seeing the world and ways of being in the world and a very different kind of brain. And it would be hell to have a kid like that and try and figure out how in the world do we try to help this person develop into a normal, independent adult.
Yeah. Fascinating conversation as always. Siobhan Scott, psychotherapist and author, The Minds of Mass Killers, available wherever you get books. And also her, there's a camera over here, Nightbird, your autobiography, which is very, very good. I highly suggest checking it out wherever books are sold. If you wanted a window into contradiction, the Idaho State Police just handed us a whole house tour. We're talking about more than 500 images from Brian Koberger's world, his WSU apartment, his Elantra, the quiet corners where routine meets aftermath. On one side, you have the everyday signs of a grand student or a grad student, textbooks cracked open, assignments floating around the room, birthday cards from family dropping in just days after the murders. And on the other, you have the method, the bagged hairs, the stained bedding, the car pulled apart and dusted like it's giving up state secrets. The place looks almost underdecorated or undecorated, impersonal, like it was a temporary living stage set, if you will. But in the spaces where his body would have been after the crimes and before, the bed, the living room, things read as scrubbed, controlled, purposeful, and very much in line with what you'd expect from the home of Brian Koberger. In the spaces he didn't expect to matter, pantry, cupboards, a little domestic junk drawer of life, chaos. Here's why it all still matters now. These photos won't change outcomes, but they do refine the public record. They help us understand how he operated when no one was watching, what he prioritized, what he ignored, where he anticipated scrutiny, and where he gambled he could get away with mess. The Elantra tells its own story. White residue from processing parts essentially disassembled. If the working belief was you can't clean everything, the counterpoint is on those seats, pedals, and seams, he tried. The question becomes not just what investigators found, but what the patterns of cleaning and not cleaning signal about planning, panic, and the mental load of covering up violence in a small life. Ethically, there's another line to walk. Families don't want graphic images out there. I hear that. You hear that. And most of what's been released so far avoids the worst of that. Still, the scale of the dump guaranteed misreads. People scour photos for meaning that really isn't there. So our job here is to look closely without pretending a pile of grocery shelf chaos is a diagnostic manual. We're going to parse what's actually probative and what's just voyeuristic. Joining me to do just that, Jennifer Coffendaffer, retired FBI special agent. We've both pored over these photos, Jen. We've now seen inside that so-called home lair of Brian Koberger, whatever you want to call it. Anything standing out to you?
I mean, really what stood out to me, and I tried to point this out, I'm not sure if I did a great job at it, but basically the areas where he would be, where his body would have been after the crimes, any place he would have touched in that sort of regard, like his bed, his living room, where was he, seemed very clean. What really I found interesting was his pantry, his icebox, other areas that were just completely disheveled. What it showed to me was that it seemed that he was very OCD, if you will, when it came to cleanup, but probably not that OCD. And I'm using that as a term to mean, you know, concerned about how things are kept. Mm-hmm. He didn't seem to be that way with his normal routine.
That stood out to me as well. And I know you tweeted about it too, because we look at so many things about him and we think, oh gosh, he must be so OCD the way he wants to control everything. And we've even seen that footage from inside his cell, his Crocs lined up very neatly. Things are very much in their place. But when we got a chance to see inside his house, fairly unextraordinary, not a whole lot on the walls, if anything at all, but yeah, I mean, the kitchen was kind of in disarray. The cupboards were kind of in disarray. Were you surprised by that?
I really was. And of course, many of us have watched that footage in his cell, as you mentioned, you know, his shoes all lined up. He's cleaning about. He's lining everything up. Listen, I understand that there's multiple layers to a true diagnosis of being OCD. But I'm talking about somebody who, when it came to cleaning up after this crime, wow, this was somebody who was organized and methodical and couldn't clean enough. And so to me, that stuck out as him trying to cover everything up.
Does it also show, I mean, they always say, you know, like things around you are kind of a reflection of what's in your head, as scientific as of saying that is, I know. But it is, I think, somewhat true. If things are kind of in disarray around you, oftentimes it does kind of reflect what may be going on with one personally. Do you think that the disarray in this area that was just the closest to Brian Koberger, nobody else is interacting with his, you know, can of Pringles and chips and things that are sitting around the house other than him, but all those things that were just meant for him, just only for him to see, only for him to be concerned with, bothered by, consumed, whatever, all of that was in a disarray, while all of the forward-sitting things, the forward-focusing things that people can see on the outside were not. It really kind of showed an interesting, you know, on the inside, he didn't seem to be in all that of an organized human being.
Well, I truly think that nexus had to do with the cleanup. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at his bathroom. Oh, my goodness. I mean, and I mean, it was unbelievable. And yeah, juxtapose that, like I tried to do, to the cupboard. And to me, it just pointed out that when he cared about something being perfect and in order, because he was probably worried about, could there be blood spatter or other hairs or anything else? I'm going to get this cleaned up methodically. But where I don't think it could be, I don't think he gave a crap.
We've seen, you know, the stained bedding and bagged hairs documented. When they went into this this scene, how are they deciding what could be potential evidence versus just everyday contamination?
Well, I tell you what, when you work a case like this, Tony, and you go in, you are taking everything. You're erring on that side of complete caution. In other words, you don't want to miss anything. So anything you see that even might be blood or bodily fluid or a pet hair that could be relevant, you are taking that all. And, you know, we've seen crime scenes where they haven't done that, and that's never good.
The Elantra, we know, was photographed, and it had some white powdery residue on it from processing. We also heard from investigators that the car was basically disassembled. And obviously, yes, they did some more disassembling when they went through to try and get anything out of it. What does that tell you about someone? And how often is it that a perpetrator is able to literally disassemble the car to such a level that they're not able to really get much of anything out of the vehicle, which, I mean, as far as we know, there really wasn't much found within the confines of that vehicle in terms of any sort of DNA or anything, really.
Well, there were so many of us, Tony, that said, mm-hmm. listen, and this was based on our experience, right? You can cover up a lot, but you can't cover up typically blood that would spatter down between that seat or on that gear shift or on those pedals if it was on your feet. You can't cover up everything. Well, you know what? Brian Koberger proved us all wrong because he went to the nth degree to disassemble that car and make sure every crevice and cranny was thoroughly cleaned. And as far as that, you know, kind of that spray of where they process, I think, you know, I was trying to make the point, fingerprints, DNA, or was he really looking for were they also looking for bleach and cleaning mm-hmm. solvents? That's what really I believe they were looking for more than anything, is to show cleanup products being used as opposed to fingerprints or anything like that. I mean, I've dusted for fingerprints before. It typically isn't that hot mess you see there. I think it was for other things they were looking for as well.
And what do we know about that yet? Do we have any of that data in terms of what, you know, what they did find, what they didn't find in terms of cleaning supplies and such? Obviously, you know, I remember back when they emptied a lot of the stuff out of that apartment, and we were all looking at, like, they had trucks full of stuff they were taking out of there. If I remember, there was mattresses and things. But I mean, when they take all that out and they go and take a look at it, and obviously the trial never took place, do we know yet what was all found exactly after examination in the home of Koberger?
Well, it's interesting because all we know really is what Ann Taylor said mm-hmm. in one of her motion responses or motions. That's what we know, her paperwork filed. And remember, this caused a huge, you know, incensed sort of statement. Because basically the prosecution was saying, whoa, 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 I thought everything was sealed and we had a gag order and you were finessing information really underneath that gag order by putting it in your motions and in your responses. And essentially in that's when she got to make this huge statement. Listen, there was no DNA found anywhere. Mm-hmm. I think what she wrote, I think it was DNA. I don't think she went so far to say as bodily fluids. I recall DNA. And again, that was a big moment. But other than that, Tony, that's all we really know.
I mean, could there be more out there? Could there be more that we just don't know? I mean, there was speculation for a long time. You know, was there animal hair in his apartment from the dog at King Road? Was there anything else? Are there still more pieces to this puzzle that have not yet dropped out of the box yet?
Well, I think, Tony, we all anticipated that happening. And so far, it hasn't come up. Really, we still have the backbone of this case being the PCA. Mm-hmm. Adding to that a little bit, you know, the search of Amazon and him purchasing the case was truly spelled out in that PCA. And I think there's been very little to really bolster their case beyond that. But we haven't seen the lab results. We have not seen anything from the FBI yet. So there's so much we haven't seen.
I guess the question is why? And will we?
Well, Tony, I think it'll take a while. Remember, at least according to the court, meaning Judge Hippler, he said, listen, nothing is getting out into the public until I have a chance to review. Now, do I think that's Judge Hippler looking at all of these terabytes of information? No. I think he has a staff and other people helping. But the bottom line is that's what he said. He doesn't want a lot going out without their review. So that makes it difficult. We also know, you know, now mm-hmm. that a lot won't possibly come out because the families are upset. They don't mm-hmm. want these crime scene pictures and more pictures, anything bloody, anything of their kids coming out, which I can hardly blame them. I've said, sure. Even if I see them, I'm not putting them up. Yeah. That's at least the dignity that I think they deserve and they've asked for.
And that's a big thing, because we keep seeing stuff like that popping out. I have not witnessed anything bloody. I don't know if it's out there. I don't really want to see it. I hope that we don't really see any of that coming out. And obviously we do have a lot of pushback from the families, and understandably so. I don't quite see the purpose other than just transparency with the public. And then here's our information. But there's obviously, I don't know that gruesome crime scene photos have any place in the public sphere. I guess if you really wanted them, you could, I don't know if for investigative purposes, find some way. But I don't really see what the purpose is of those getting out into the public anyhow.
Well, I think, Tony, the backlash on the other side is from media has to do with all the other crime scene photos we've seen. We've seen Benet, you know, guillotined up. We've seen, or not guillotined, sorry, garroted up. Yeah. We've seen crime scene photos from the Menendez. All the famous cases and cases that aren't famous, we get to see crime scene photos. Madeline Soto, I mean, let me tell you, some of those things I can't unsee, unfortunately.
Yeah.
Really to do with his bizarre looking anatomy that was not normal. But I digress. My point is, and the point they're trying to make is, look, why are we covering all of this up or not allowing it to be out when it's out in all these other cases? And my point back to the people is, listen, you don't have families screaming about this, going to the level of hiring attorneys to file motions. This is very important to them. Mm-hmm. So let's honor that.
All right. So let's zoom out and be honest about what those images actually buy us. They don't hand over a smoking gun. They do something a little subtler. They show discipline, where he's expected to have scrutiny and sloppiness where he didn't. Meticulous bathroom and bed areas versus a pantry war zone, a car processed to the nth degree, because he probably anticipated that's where a story could hide. If you're trying to read the offender's mind, that split screen is the tell. It says, I'm not tidy by nature. I'm tidy when I have to be. That's a posture, not a personality. And it lines up with what we know about offenders who plan the optics of their lives as much as the logistics. We also hit the ethics wall, and it's worth staying there for a second. Transparency is not a moral free-for-all. You can inform the public without turning grief into content. Families drawing lines around what is and isn't acceptable are not trying to rewrite history. They're trying to live with it. Most of us don't need to see blood to understand horror. And frankly, the banality of these apartment shots, the grocery debris, the blanks on the walls, the sterile emptiness, that's disturbing in its own way. It tells you a person can be sitting in a life that looks like nothing and still be capable of everything. When the volume of material is this big, it's easy to start treating every scuff, smudge, and cupboard as a breadcrumb. That's how you wind up making meaning out of noise. What matters is pattern and priority. The clean zones, the likely path of post-offense movement, the tools and cleaners that might have been used, the vehicle treated almost like a crime scene in its own right. Those pieces hold up over time. They teach and they warn. Here's where I land. This release should narrow our focus, not widen our speculation. It reminds us that performers can look organized when it's performative, and be a mess when they think they're offstage. It also reminds us that evidence tells us two stories, the one in the lab and the one in our head. We only get to publish one of those responsibly. We're going to leave this part here and pivot, because there's another thread that needs stitching. The photos show the interior. The late released antidotes show the mask, those small, unsettling micro interactions, that sketch of who he was in public spaces, the billing blow up at a hotel desk that we're going to talk about, the charm switch up, the hallway chatter about knives and sheaths, moments that don't prove cases but do reveal patterns. We're going to be diving into that next. Be sure to press subscribe so you don't miss that conversation. Wherever you're listening to us or watching us, be sure to hit that subscribe button. Just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, as we'll dive into the micro encounters of Brian Koberger next. You know, hitting on people, talking about knife sheaths. Yeah, before a murder. That's coming up. Stick around. I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Brewski and the Hidden Killers podcast.